We now turn more specifically to the development of medical care and the advances in bioethical reflection that took place during the period of the Renaissance, particularly from the end of the 15th and then in through the 16th and beginning of the 17th centuries. This was a period of real growth and development in observational science throughout Europe. There was a desire to correlate what had been believed in the past with what could be observed in the present. And this was particularly important in the area of medicine, and one of the outstanding pioneers of observational medicine during this period is the anatomist, the surgeon and professor of medicine, Andreas Vesalius, who lived from the beginning up till just a little after the middle of the 16th century. Vesalius was a physician from a family of physicians, although he was also connected with members of his family who had practiced surgery. And this, as I've mentioned before, was an important distinction. Surgery did not require advanced study or degree. That is to say, one did not have to understand the treatment of what we would today regard as the appropriate provenance of a physician specializing in internal medicine, illnesses that can't be treated surgically that would require medication or other kinds of therapy. Surgery didn't require that, and in fact, unfortunately, some surgery was undertaken by people who had rather minimal skills, but Vesalius was very much an exception to this. He trained as both a surgeon and as a physician, and he, unlike many of his predecessors on taking a position to lecture in a surgery and anatomy at Padua, he noted that the primary text that they were using for the study of anatomy, which had been written by Galen, the famous physician of ancient Rome who died around the year 200 and who left behind many texts on a whole variety of medical subjects. Galen had been limited in his anatomical observations by the fact that performing dissections on human bodies was significantly frowned upon, and one acquired one's experience through battlefield surgery on the one hand, and then by examining animals. He had the opportunity to examine apes and to write down his observations. And unfortunately, many of the things that he wrote down were true of some primates, but not necessarily true of human beings. And so Vesalius noticed that the anatomical texts that were being used did not exactly jive with what was being observed in the classroom in the dissection laboratory. Dissections of human cadavers were generally of executed criminals at this time. It was required that there would be a public dissection once or twice per year in most medical schools, but Vesalius began to take a real interest in accurate anatomy, and so rather than leaving the dissections to an assistant, to a trained barber surgeon, he undertook them himself with students standing around and watching, and he began to collect very detailed descriptions and artistic renderings of what he saw. So Vesalius became convinced that what was needed were more complete textbooks of anatomy that were based on actual observation and not simply reading Galen. He published a set of these, was offered the opportunity to continue to do dissections in the medical schools in which he taught, and eventually published a very important and famous collection of medical texts called De Humani Corporis Fabrica, on the structure of the human body, and I've given you a couple of pictures from this illustration, one from the side illustrating the musculature of the human body, and the other from in front demonstrating both musculature and the ribs and where the muscles originate and where they insert. Technical anatomical terms for how they connect to the bones on which they pull. And it's hard to appreciate how significant this was. The medieval approach, as I've mentioned before, to received authors was to generally believe them if they were thought to be trustworthy. rather than performing experiments oneself, it was regarded as rather unnecessary because these things had already been described. And the other thing that had not been in existence in the Middle Ages were very accurate anatomical texts, that is, careful artistic renderings of the human body and of the human organ systems. These Vesalius began to supply. They became very popular, and it's hard to imagine how important this was because it meant that now surgeons and physicians who also undertook surgery could anticipate things not only on the basis of having done it on the battlefield, but by having studied it in theory in a textbook, and then also by perhaps having seen it in a dissection themselves. And the desire for, if you will, truth, for what is actually present in the body and what can actually be observed, became more and more a part of presumed medical study, with some reservations that we'll talk about in future lectures. This desire to understand the structure of the body more completely was also taken up by the important scientists, not necessarily physicians, but scientists of the age, such as Leonardo da Vinci, who also conducted dissections, but whose drawings are nowhere near as accurate as those of Vesalius for the most part. He was interested in the application of human anatomy, in particular in the fields of art, and to some extent in architecture and in understanding the fundamental proportions of the universe itself. His famous drawing of the Vitruvian Man, this male figure with extended arms, which has a perfect square and a perfect circle around it, is based on an architectural text by Vitruvius, which Leonardo has interpreted as relating to the various proportions of the sizes of various parts of the human body, which are, according to him, rather significant proportions that correspond to almost the mystical nature of numbers within the universe itself. And I've also included among these pictures his description or his depiction of shoulder anatomy as well. Some of his anatomical drawings are quite good. Others, particularly his drawings of the human brain and skull, are a bit more fanciful and are obviously based only on partial dissections. I've also included Michelangelo's drawings for the simple reason that he himself also observed dissections in order to understand the human body better and in order to be able to paint and sculpt and otherwise depict it. And so this became a part of the artistic and of the growing scientific tradition of the 16th century, a desire to engage in what would today probably be referred to as experimentation, that is, one's own observation becomes the basis for ongoing extension of knowledge. This is also seen in the life of a very wonderful and noble physician-surgeon named Ambrose Paré, who lived at roughly the same time as Vesalius. And Paré had a very compassionate nature, and one of the stories that's told about him that illustrates his whole approach to the care of patients is something that I've described in the text that you have above the pictures of Paré, and that is that when he was working as a wartime surgeon. And this was at the time where hand weapons, small guns and muskets, small by the tradition of antiquity, that is, they were no longer just cannons intended to destroy buildings, but weapons that were actually intended to be directed specifically against people. These muskets and early firearms caused horrific injuries, and often carried with them parts of the individual's clothing into the wound, and so there was always a terrible danger of infection. And the standard treatment for gunshot wounds was to pour boiling oil into the open wound after the bullet and whatever else could be extracted had been removed. As you can imagine, this was horrifically painful, and one day he discovered that he didn't have any more oil. The only thing that was available to him was a compound that was intended to be used in treating other kinds of ailments, and it was apparently composed of turpentine, an egg mixture, and rose oil. And with great fear and trepidation, rather than pouring boiling oil into the wounded soldier's wounds, he used this material. And he, as he describes it later, he spent a completely sleepless night. He was terrified that he had done something wrong and that he had treated these men badly and that they were going to be in bad shape. And he woke up the next morning, discovered to his astonishment that those who had been treated with what was the recommended therapy of boiling oil were all in terrible pain and their wounds were inflamed, whereas those he had treated with this material containing turpentine, which by the way, would have been somewhat antiseptic, were doing quite well. They were not feverish. Their wounds were not as badly inflamed. And so he resolved as a result of this never to use boiling oil again. He also, as his experience in the battlefields taught him, wanted to find ways of treating those who had been badly wounded and maimed, who had been subjected to amputations. And so he tried to find various forms of artificial limbs that would be valuable to him. And this diagram of a rather complicated artificial hand reflects his and others' quests at this time to try to find ways of compensating for limbs and body parts that have been lost. He also attempted to treat mutilations, which were sometimes inflicted for public punishments of individuals. Sometimes individuals would have their noses cut off for having committed various crimes, or it could have happened in dueling. And so he tried to find ways of giving them some sort of an artificial prosthesis that would be of help to them, and even of attempting something that had been done in India and elsewhere. And that was to effectively transplant part of the skin from the arm onto the face in stages by freshening the skin of the arm, bandaging the arm to the head, attaching it or pushing it down on a freshly made wound over the area where the nose had been amputated, and then leaving the person's arm in place for a long period of time until there was some blood supply established. And again, this is very analogous to the kind of flap techniques that are sometimes used in modern cosmetic surgery. And again, in surgery for people who need a very serious and significant reconstruction. So he was very far-thinking, and he was very, very convinced of the need for concern for and care for his patients. Another thing that he did was to not use large sutures when he was dealing with facial injuries especially, but to instead attach a kind of a sticky material on which was connected to cardboard bandages, which he would then draw together and tie together in order to keep the wound together without having to use treatment that would certainly result in large scars. And I've noted that his motto reflects his deep personal piety, that although it is I who bandage, it is God who heals. So particularly Paré and Vesalius are reflections of the development of medical science in the 16th century and the beginnings of an application of science to medicine that would become more important in subsequent centuries. Now, this is particularly true in the area of surgery. However, there were the limitations that since there was no antisepsis, there was no particular concern for keeping instruments clean, infection was a very real and constant problem, and indeed resulted in death if abdominal surgery were attempted, or particularly if surgery involved opening the dura, the tough membrane that surrounds the brain. So there were very significant limitations to what could be done, even with an increased and more accurate knowledge of anatomy. And of course, at this time, there was no really effective form of anesthesia other than compression and the use of opiates, neither of which were fully effective. So this is a reminder of the fact that there is the development and beginnings of the application of science to medicine, but there were significant limitations to this, as we shall see. The humor theory was very widespread and widely accepted, and so treatments for medical, that is to say non-surgical conditions, were also were often based on theories that were as fallacious as Aquinas' notion of ensoulment and animation. And so it would wait for several centuries for the advances that were beginning to be made in the area of surgery in the 16th century to then be applied in the area of internal medicine.